From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, the effects of television on American culture. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are three scholars who recently participated in a symposium at the National Humanities Center. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Mimi White of the Pembroke Center for Teaching and Research on Women at Brown University. Following that, a discussion with Robert Stamm of New York University and John Fisk of Curtin University in Australia. The holy wars of television evangelists have recently focused public attention on religious broadcasting. According to Mimi White, religion on television clearly diverges from mainstream programming, but the two forms share an important similarity. This is the common element of therapy, or an emphasis on interpersonal relationships. Here is Mimi White.
I'm interested in therapy not only in religious broadcasting, but as a kind of paradigm, to share your 50-cent word, for something that seems to me a pervasive thematic that runs through television.
So we're not talking here anymore just about religious programming. We'd be talking about what do you want to call it, mainstream programming?
Yeah.
For example?
Everything from Hotel to The Equalizer, Magnum P.I., Divorce Court, Newlywed Game, all of those kinds of things, and even talk shows in some sense, although it's a slightly different thing going on there. When I talk about therapy, I'm particularly focusing on interpersonal relations.
As depicted on television.
Right. Representations of interpersonal relations in which the relationship is structured through a strategy or a kind of practice of confession with the goal of improving one's life.
Is this a conscious thing? I take it that it would be among the script writers, that they may not call one another up and say, what kind of confessional device are we going to use on this or that script? But there seems to be a consensus here. Is that what you're telling me?
I think there's a consensus, but I think that it's symptomatic of a much broader cultural interest or preoccupation with this kind of thing. And I guess the reason I've insisted on the confession and the interpersonal nature is that there has been a lot of stuff to talk about consumer culture as therapeutic. But basically that word is used to mean something that will improve your life or can cure your life. So the idea that you can buy a product and it will change your life, or if you eat a proper way, you know, a diet regime or an exercise regime will cure your problems, improve your life.
So this comes out of a real context.
And that's right, exactly. And but that's a kind of self-help notion of therapy that I'm saying isn't the only thing that's going on. What's more that's going on is the idea that you have to go talk to someone. You have to aloud speak your life. You have to describe what's going on with you to someone else, which also establishes a kind of power relationship.
Well, the structure, the substance structure, help me with this, of soap operas, both of those come to mind.
Exactly.
Endless talking about one's situation.
And people using that talk to manipulate things. You know, people overhearing, hearing things they're not supposed to, can ruin someone's life.
Well, what kind of a spin are you putting on this? Are you being critical of it? Are you simply saying, there it is, we need to be aware that there is a therapeutic confessional dimension to Phil Donahue, Oprah Winfrey, all the Newlywed Game, whatever?
I think I'm saying there it is, and I'm asking people to be a bit more critical or skeptical, because it's been promoted. I mean, one sort of way this is promoted also in the media, if you, for example, read, you know, women's magazines and Psychology Today and all the pop psychology literature, is this is liberatory and progressive.
Yeah, it's been going on there for a long time.
Exactly. And I guess what I want to inject in it is that it also involves power relations.
How so? Are you talking about the man-woman power relation? You're talking about, help me with
it. Both man, woman, doctor, patient. I mean, it's you know, when one confesses in the religious sense, you know, you supplicate, you make yourself, you abase yourself to a higher power. Mm-hmm. The same thing goes on if you're a patient and you talk to it. I mean, the patient-doctor relation is a power relation. So, and the more knowledge the doctor has, the more potentially has to wield power over you as mm-hmm. well as help you. And that this kind of progressive liberatory notion of help is always accompanied by the potential for power and abuse of power.
I see. What in the world happened to the good old Aristotelian beginning, middle, end? We turn the tube on and all we want is escape, and here comes some academic who's telling me that, goodness gracious, they're brainwashing me and I'm having real trouble facing my problems. I have to confess, television is a therapeutic device. Help me with that.
I don't think it's brainwashing. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm looking at this as symptomatic of a kind of prevalent view of culture, mm-hmm. culture expressing itself.
So this is not just TV. Again,
exactly.
you're connecting this with a larger fabric.
But I'm looking at TV. And I think in terms of I just want to escape, everyone just wants entertainment and escape. That's all I ever want when I come home. But the point is that the question is in symbolic terms, not in empirical terms, but in symbolic terms, why do some things function as escape?
Uh-huh.
And why not others? People have a lot of choices, and I don't mean they have the three networks as choices. I mean there's television, they could play an instrument, they could, you know, take up knitting or crocheting, although some people do that while they watch TV.
Right.
They can read a magazine, a book, and when I say a book, I mean everything from the National Enquirer to William Shakespeare. It doesn't have to be a high literary book.
Right.
They can be involved in sports. And most people are actually do a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of people watch a lot of television. I'm one of them. I love TV.
Uh-huh. Fair enough.
I'm not going to pretend I don't. And the question is, how and why this kind of thematics of therapy and these structures of therapy that I see, you know, appear on daytime TV, nighttime TV, in genres that are supposedly appeal to men, mm-hmm. in genres that supposedly appeal to women, in even something like CBN that tries so hard to be a distinctive alternative, that must be a symbolic structure that has some meaning. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what its causes are or its effects in some empirical sense, but I'm looking at this kind of symbolic field.
Mm-hmm. Let's be specific for a couple of minutes, Mimi White. Before our taping session, you said that you have great fun with programs like The Dating Game.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here? Not only confession and therapy, we're talking about euphemisms. We're talking about one's very personal life.
Exactly.
Wrap that up in a package for me.
I'm interested in those shows because they're about the formations of couples, how couples come to be.
Socializing.
Right. They're about, exactly. And socializing, specifically heterosexual relations, mm-hmm. male, female, getting into couples, then how couples, if you get to the newlywed game, it's what happens once you get married.
Mm-hmm.
And these people come on and they talk.
Oh, boy.
And they talk about anything.
Uh-huh.
And some people feel that a lot of sort of popular critics talk about those shows as degrading to the people who go on them.
Consumer porn.
Right. In a sense. But my feeling is those people know. They know what those shows are before they go on.
Mm-hmm.
And on the newlywed game, for example, there's always a question about whoopee, which means having sex, making
mm-hmm.
love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost inevitably some question that refers to it, and that's what it's always called. How many times last week did you make whoopee,
mm-hmm.
and for how long? Or what is the most unusual place? Or where was the first time?
Mm-hmm. So what? What's your point here?
But I guess when the fact is that in a sense, is a measure of what it's all right to talk about.
Uh-huh.
And how it's all right to talk
and
about.
And therefore it has a connection with the notion of therapy.
Right, exactly. And that you're supposed to talk about those things.
Uh-huh.
Not to yourself, but to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to. And they set up a kind of norm of expectation and measurement, it seems to me. I think, or on Love Connection, which is a kind of dating game type show, there's often the host of the show will ask the people if they got romantic, which is a euphemism for not necessarily having sex, but how much physical interaction they had. Did you kiss a lot?
Mm-hmm.
And again, You're supposed to think about those things. It's as if they're setting up a series of guidelines. It's all right to think about how much sex you do or don't have on a first date. Mm-hmm. It's all right if you're a married couple. It's expected that you'll talk about having sex. It's perfectly all right on the newlywed game to ask people when the first time they made whoopee was, or the first place, when the assumption is, a priori, the assumption is it was before they were ever married. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of content, that's different from, in terms of point of view, sort of, that's different from the 700 Club, where adultery and premarital sex and all of those are obviously taboo, but they also have to be talked about there.
Yeah.
In other words, to be an alternative, Pat Robertson can't ignore sex and sexual behavior. He has to raise it as an issue almost as much as it's raised as an issue in tacky shows like The Newlywed Game.
You're also talking, Mimi White, about our cultural conceptions, not only of therapy and confession, but of privacy.
And of
individuality? I don't know. That may be too big a word for what we're getting at here. But we're on the right track.
Yeah, I think the notion of privacy is really important. And I got interested in it. The very first thing I did in all of this was work on the love connection, and I called it, the paper, my first version of it, The Personal is Public, or How TV Helps You Make a Love Connection. Yeah. And the idea that there's a show called Couples where real people, I'll put that in quotation marks, but not actors, not faked people, go and talk to a marriage counselor.
You mean they tape this
stuff. The session is taped and then edited for a half-hour show.
Goodness.
And the idea that what is, you know, represented and representable on TV is what we have conventionally thought of as being the most private or intimate parts of our lives, things we would share with our families or our close friends, and we would choose who we talked to about those things, who we told these stories to. And it's become perfectly naturalized for all of this to be public fare, mass media.
We're talking about the global village and everybody's running around naked.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's interesting to me about that is a lot of arguments about television historically emphasized the way, and about broadcasting, first radio in the 30s and then television in the 50s, the way they were an entertainment form that helped privatize our society. Uh-huh. You know, that image of everyone private, sitting in their own homes, the glow of the TV light.
Clustered around. No one
talking to each other. But the point is that privacy is what they're watching.
Yeah. And
so there's been a reverse, and the increasing privatization and fragmentation of individuals is now sort of being glued over because they're sharing their privateness with everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Is all of this a good thing or a bad thing? Or is that for you to say?
I'm not sure it's for me to say.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what it gives with one hand, it takes away with the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, that to the extent that it supposedly makes us more open and liberates us, it extricates us in further networks of power, which we aren't even aware of. And we just have to be cautious about it.
Mimi White participated in a recent symposium on television and history at the National Humanities Center. While on leave from Northwestern University, she spent a year at the Pembroke Center for Teaching and Research on Women at Brown University, where she worked on a forthcoming study about television, therapy, and gender. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Television and American Culture continues now with a discussion featuring two other recent visitors at the center, Robert Stamm of New York University and John Fisk of Curtin University in Australia. According to Robert Stamm and John Fisk, one of the pleasures for viewers of TV journalism is an empowering and ubiquitous perspective on world and local events. For many viewers, this perspective exists in an illusion of domestic security, reinforced daily at the dinner hour by a happy family of broadcasters.
One of the words that John Fiske used in his presentation in this symposium is ideology. which is a pretty tough term. How do you translate, again, how do we move from the apparent simplicity of watching television, electronic journalism, into a rather high-flown kind of concept like that? Here you just use the word power, empowering. Help me with that, John.
Well, the connection between simplicity and ideology is absolutely crucial, because ideology works most effectively when it appears to be most commonsensical and simple. Mm-hmm. That's when our guard is down, if you like. So what do I mean by ideology? What I don't mean is that ideology is something the Russians have and we don't. You know, that's the sort of common sense media use of it, which is a thoroughly dishonest and unproductive way of using the term. Mm-hmm. Now, ideology is an organization of common sense, if you like, that what constitutes a common sense, ordinary, naturalized way of making sense of the world and making sense of ourselves and making sense of our relationship to the rest of that world. Mm-hmm. Now, the crucial thing is that it appears to be commonsensical. What it disguises is the fact that this view of the world serves the interests of some groups of people very well indeed.
All right, now who is being served and who is being disserved in this ideological view of... I take it that we're talking about American commercial television journalism. That's the focal point.
That's the medium.
Uh-huh.
Now, the relationship between the dominant ideology of a society or a culture and its institutions, of which the media are but one, mm-hmm. is a very complex one, and we mustn't reduce it to a very simple notion that in some way the barons of the industry and the political leaders and the judicial system and so on mm-hmm. are all somehow in a conspiratorial relationship.
Right.
That is working to impose their view on the world upon the powerless, the subordinate, not just in American society, but in any society.
Well, we come back to what Bob Stamm was saying about the view as a participant, and I take it here in the most basic of senses, an unwitting, an unknowing participant in the construction of this ideology. Are we on the right track there,
yeah,
Bob?
Yeah, I think so. Also, I'd like to pick up on something that John was saying, and he talks about looking through the camera at a world that looks pretty awful. You know, if you watch local news, there's the daily harvest of murders and rapes,
right.
and children's all, and all of babies in garbage cans.
All of it framed in this family to family kind
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly, right. From our family to yours is a very common slogan. So the impression you get is you're in a warm, trustworthy space in your home and in the studio. And I think one of the pleasures, especially of local news, which is very different from network news, is this idea of an ideal family and an ideal community.
Now that's
where
a crucial distinction.
I think so.
Yeah.
And the happy news team represents our community in an ideal form, because uh-huh. you find a kind of ethnic utopia. You get representatives, in every sense of that word, of the different communities within the larger community.
Uh-huh.
But it's a laughing community, and it's a place where work becomes play, as in a musical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have the same pleasure we have in a musical comedy that we have in certain respects in local news.
Yeah. The local news is, it's from the basis of the happy family.
Uh-huh.
Now, what we can say then is that, say that there is a story about incest,
mm-hmm.
about wife battering, spouse battering, that these sort of stories are not used, the sense that's made of them is not used to interrogate what's going on in the nuclear family, in the sort of society and the social pressures it's under now.
There's some reverse steps being left out here.
No, quite the reverse. They're being used as uh-huh. in order to reestablish the norms that the nuclear family is the healthy cornerstone of American society.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's an ideological notion.
Are you telling me that if the television, the electronic journalist told us what really was happening, that the medium as we know it, that is the device as we know it, would fall apart, would not be adequate to what it's attempting to do?
Now, I'm not saying it would fall apart. What I am saying is that there are alternative meanings, say, of stories like wife battering, child abuse, or
all
what have you.
Give me an example.
There are meanings here that interrogate the notion of the nuclear family
mm-hmm.
as being the apple pie and cream idea.
Happy family.
Now, those sort of meanings are quite repressed. They're ruled out of court by the form of local news, by the style of it, by its easy assumption that the happy family is the natural, commonsensical place from which to make sense of the world. And there's no sense of the internal interrogation of the norms of that family.
Mm-hmm. Bob Stamp?
Yeah, I think what's being left out is the idea of a system of relations of power, and that within the family, perhaps incest is a consequence of male power or patriarchal power, which is more general. And to give a parallel example, if you think of the many stories you see both on local and network news about the homeless, for instance, in New York, Pat Harper dressed up as a bag lady and lived for a very brief period the life of the homeless. And it was a very moving kind of show, and she concluded by saying, this can't go on, something must be done. These are people like ourselves, and this can't be tolerated. What was missing is the relations of power that lead to some people being homeless, which is really within kind of a social Darwinist survival of the fittest ethic, which creates naturally both extremely rich and extremely poor people.
John?
Well, I think there are a number of agencies at work here, and that, again, I don't want to suggest there is this conspiratorial alliance between them. Equally, though, I don't want to suggest that there's no intentionality at all. Mm-hmm. Of course, the news, I mean, to take a cynical definition of print news, news is what's printed on the back of advertisements.
That's cynical indeed.
Yeah, but there's more than a grain of truth in it. So that the advertisers who place their spots within a news program are not directly going to say, we must have this sort of news, but they're going to, quite naturally, want to place their spots in the sort of program that provides the right ambience for their products.
Is it as simple as news as entertainment? Is that what we're talking about? Bob Stamm?
Well, the whole idea of entertainment is kind of a red herring in a sense, because it's a way of saying it's just something. It's a way of not taking something seriously. You see a film and you're moved by it or you hate it, and then someone says, well, it's just entertainment. In fact, it's a social representation which involves our lives and how it's represented and how we feel about it and about power. So I think the entertainment issue, for instance, the German playwright Bertolt Brecht pointed out that the whole idea of entertainment versus education is an insult to both, because it implies that education is not fun, and it implies that entertainment doesn't teach you anything. Mm-hmm. So it's a very false dichotomy. So I think it just leads us to kind of a morass in terms of theorizing what's good or bad in television. To pick up on what John was saying, I think not only do we not want to be conspiratorial, but that, for instance, the example of Pat Harper living the life of the homeless, that's very good that people have some sense of what it's like through her. At the same time, you have to point out the limitations. In terms of local news, it's very beautiful that the image is one of racial harmony. Mm-hmm. But you need more. You need structural changes to really make that a reality in our everyday lives.
Well, let me pick a fight with you for a moment. The broadcast journalists are going to say, wait a minute, what do you want? We're doing the best job we can. We're all well-intentioned people. We try our best to be objective. There's a sort of wonderful word that we could kick around for a while. Be specific for me. What exactly might we have them do, these people who make the decisions about what we see on television news, to, as you say, broaden the perspective, the device by which we absorb the world around us?
Yeah, well, of course, the news professionals, the news journalists, don't do the best job they can do. They do the easiest job they can do. They follow their own conventions of news gathering. They each of them have their conventional news rounds. So that, for instance, if you want stories on problems in industry, then you go to particular management or union organizations to get that information. What you don't do is you don't go to the local hospitals to see where the industrial accidents are. Now, there are more days lost through industrial accidents and injury than through strikes. But because it's much harder, technically harder and more expensive to get that information, because it's not already organized and codified by social institutions, then that sort of information is not part of normal industrial news reporting. We cannot operate in a democracy if we don't have adequate information flow. The only way that we can get adequate flow of information is through an independent news service, news system. against this. There's a contradiction that they're in it to make money.
Mm-hmm.
They have to make money. They have to entertain. They have to get audiences.
And when you say independent, you mean independent of that financial impulse?
I mean, what they mean, independent of government.
Uh-huh.
Now, the so-called free press is very suspicious of a government-funded or government-supplied information service. It immediately thinks of Moscow. What it doesn't think of is that a commercial press, because free means commercial, and of course the last thing it is free,
that's right.
That a commercial press has just as many constraints upon the sort of information it gives, the breadth of that information, as does the Moscow government press,
uh-huh.
And that perhaps socially and politically, if we believe that a broad range of information is vital for the continuance of a democracy, we need to look at some other way of funding the gathering and distribution of that information, rather than leaving it simply to advertisers to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
And while at the beginning of this interview, we were talking about the dominant ideology structured into the news.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to end the interview by saying, sure, it's structured in, but actually people are very good at selecting bits of the news, mm-hmm. and not buying wholesale into these dominant ideological structures.
Bob Stamp.
I mean, getting in relation to this issue of why we don't remember, I think a key phrase in the news is, and now this. And you have an odd kind of fragmentary leveling, for instance, mm-hmm. at the moment of Three Mile Island, you know, a near nuclear disaster, but you still have commercials, which on one level is very reassuring. Oh, if Coca-Cola is still advertising, maybe the world is all right. On another level, it's very disturbing because obviously that was a very serious possible disaster, and that's when you start to need real information and thinking about those issues. And I think part of the reason we don't remember is the issues are defined in very superficial ways. So in terms of Iran, we don't learn about Iran. In terms of nuclear energy, we don't learn very much about. In terms of political campaigns, we learn about the horse race, but not about which forces are being represented by certain figures and what that means in the long historical run.
Right. We're not learning about the grooms and the feeding and all of the training, the substance of it, in other words.
Right.
John Fisk teaches at Curtin University in Australia. Robert Stamm is a professor at New York University. Both participated in a recent symposium at the National Humanities Center on television and history. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Television and American Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, another in a series of discussions about the bicentennial of the Constitution of the United States. My guest will be Joyce Appleby, an historian from the University of California at Los Angeles. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about the power and price of television in American culture. Wayne's guests are scholars from Northwestern and New York universities and from Curtin University in Australia. Religious programming, television as therapy, and the ideologies of American broadcasting. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.